Before we jump into this interview, I wanted to make mention of the fact that the interview that we're presenting is designed to provide accurate and helpful information regarding whatever the subject matter is that's being covered. But we're making this available with the understanding that we're not endeavoring to be offering specific legal, accounting, medical, financial, psychological, or other professional services. Laws and regulations are continually changing, and they can vary according to location and time. So we're just not wanting to make any kind of representation that the information here that we're offering is applicable for all locations and times. And if you need legal advice, medical advice, psychological advice, accounting advice, or whatever, obviously we want you to seek out the services of competent professionals in the area of need. But we hope this is very helpful to you, and we wish you the very best as you listen. God bless you. Well, this is Tony Cook, and I'm very delighted to have with us today Dale Doty. Dr. Doty has been involved in the Christian counseling profession for decades, a long time, and I believe Christian Family Institute here in Tulsa that you're the founder of and the head of is the longest-standing Christian counseling agency in Tulsa. Is that correct?
I think that may be true.
Okay, great. Well, we're going to be talking today about a subject. I recently heard Dr. Doty speak at a seminar on the topic of sexual addiction, and I know that that's an issue that, my goodness, we just live in a world that is so saturated with sexually oriented messages and advertising, and just our culture is affected and people are affected. And I wanted to talk with Dr. Doty today about maintaining sexual sanity in a sex-crazed world. And Dr. Doty, tell me, you've been in the professional counseling arena for decades, and what are some of the scenarios that you run into as a Christian counselor? Families, couples, individuals where sexual issues have impacted people's lives and things have gotten out of control. What do you encounter?
Well, certainly the internet is one of the you know, sources of problems for a number of families these days. And I don't think a day goes by that there isn't someone in our clinic, you know, seeing one of our therapists that isn't there because of some kind of involvement in sexual material on the internet. Probably the most common scenario is when a spouse calls having found that their partner is looking at pornography on the internet. And often this is not the first time that the spouse has caught their partner. So, you know, it may be that a wife has found that her husband's looking at pornography. He's, you know, been caught before, promised to stop. It hurt the wife, you know, but, you know, she, you know, agreed to forgive him. And then, you know, some maybe months or even maybe years go by and the problem surfaces again. And, you know, this time the spouse, and maybe it's happened multiple times, you know, this could be a chronic problem. And finally the spouse, you know, calls to say, you know, this can't go on. You know, this is unacceptable. You know, we've got to get therapy. And in some cases, spouses take it just as seriously as if an affair has occurred. And so, you know, in some cases, a partner has even asked their spouse to leave the house, to move out, you know, until some kind of solution can be found. And there are others who never come to counseling at all, but we hear about these cases later where the spouse just filed for divorce, you know, just was offended, you know, wounded, and ultimately would not live with the kind of behavior. Now, often in those cases, there are other problems as well, but in some cases, the marriage is over, the partner sees no hope for their marriage and is out of there.
Mm-hmm. What happens in an individual's life when they view pornography? What is it that causes people to keep going back again and again?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly the internet provides much more graphic pornography than can be purchased over the counter. You know, many of the kinds of hardcore pornography that people view would be illegal, would be seized if it were sold in stores. And so the internet is a way that people get around local law. So, you know, the sexually stimulating nature of pornography, particularly for men, but increasingly we're finding women also involved in, you know, looking at pornography. And so it's not exclusively a male issue, but it's certainly by far the majority of those that look at the internet. In fact, 83% in a recent study of those that visited hardcore pornography sites, popular sites, were male. But that leaves another, you know, 17% that are women that view those, that material. And so I think that surprises many people that, that women also look at that material or, you know, find it, you know, find some curiosity in it or whatever. Again, the problem is that it's highly arousing. Many people who see it, you know, that there is some visual stimuli, you know, that it can become arousing, particularly to men. And large numbers of men in our culture have at some time or another viewed pornography. One study recently of those 18-year-olds graduating from high school indicated that 100% of the males graduating from high school at 18 years old had seen pornography on the internet at least on one occasion. Now, many people who see it don't have a problem with it. They see it, they, you know, they find it maybe possibly arousing or somewhat stimulating. You know, they find that they're attracted to it, but they also feel some conviction, you know, that it's not right, it's not appropriate, and they walk away from it and they don't seem to have real difficulty with it. Now, some of those same people may go back at some point in the future if they receive unsolicited email, which is a very common way that these, you know, pornographers market their material. They may see an unsolicited email and be tempted. Open the email, you know, click on the website that's listed and, you know, view the pop-up or whatever it is that, you know, that's associated with it, close it and move on. The problem, though, is that there's a number of people in our culture that once they see this material, it's very much like a drug. They find themselves strongly attracted back to that same material. They go back over and over, and the more of it they see, the more of it they want to see. Now, again, these are people who are prone toward addiction to other substances as well. So they may be prone to alcohol if they had you know, tampered with alcohol, if they'd experimented with alcohol. They may have some difficulty with impulse control, so they may go back to alcohol over and over. If they had tried drugs, they may find the same kind of reaction. Many people who are prone to addiction have underlying anxieties, you know, some source of pain, grief, guilt, you know, something of that nature that, you know, that makes them feel bad. And so what they find is while they're indulging in whatever substance or, in this case, sexual arousal, it distracts from the pain or the, you know, the discomfort that they feel otherwise.
So it's an escape.
It is. It serves kind of as a way of escaping the pain or the difficulty that they're experiencing.
You mentioned at the seminar I heard you at recently that scientists, doctors have been able to identify a specific brain chemical that gets released or something when an individual views pornography. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
In fact, you know, there are those that actually believe that sexual addiction is an addiction to a substance. The substance just happens to be secreted from our own brains. During the sexual arousal or, you know, kind of the adventure of, you know, looking at something that's sexually arousing, it's a phenylethylamine as the chemical that the brain secretes that, you know, produces a sense of, you know, pleasure and, you know, kind of a positive sensation. So, you know, whether a person's in a romantic relationship, this would be the chemical that produces the kind of feelings of romance, mm-hmm. you know, that leads people to have a strong passion or attraction for a person in a healthy relationship. Unfortunately, that same chemical reaction is evoked by, you know, surfing the net and looking for, you know, images, pleasing images or whatever. And again, the problem is that obviously that's not a human being, that's not a person, and a person gets that, though they get that positive sensation out of this, and that becomes more true as time goes on for many people. So they truly become addicted to this feeling that they experience that is a chemical reaction.
Dr. Doty, I remember one of the other things you said at this seminar that kind of shocked me was the age at which people are now exposed to pornography. Can you give some of the parameters of the timing and exposure issues of the internet and pornography?
It is quite disturbing when we think about the fact that children are seeing this material at a much, much younger age. You know, first of all, I think it's important to note that the internet is the largest business. I mean, sex is the largest business on the internet. Pornographers and those that sell sexually related material and services and that type of thing make more money than any other industry. The largest number of new sites that get started on the internet are pornography. Mm-hmm. And obviously the reason is it's profitable. So the motive behind the ones who sell this material is to make money, you know, clearly because people are vulnerable to it. You know, many parents don't realize the extent to which their children are looking at, you know, sexually related material or possibly chatting with their peers or whatever. One of the things that you know, was found by one study, and I believe this was a study that was even mentioned on James Dobson's website, was that used to be that boys first saw pornography at the average age of 11. Now, even that is quite disturbing, mm-hmm. you know, except that a recent study indicated that the number dropped to 5.
At the age of five.
So at the age of 5 – There are quite a number of kids who are using chat rooms, and so they chat with their peers from school, and many parents don't think there's anything particularly wrong with that. Mm-hmm. From the time they can type and read, many kids are starting to use the internet. And so, you know, by the age of 9 years old, 9 and 10 years old, 1/3 of all of those 9 and 10 year olds are already using chat rooms or communicating with other people over the internet. And of those children, 26% visit adult-related sites. Mm. Now, that may not be necessarily pornography, you know, but that's, you know, they're visiting adult chat rooms where sexually oriented, you know, conversations take place or things of that nature. Again, parents would say, I know where my children are, but the facts suggest otherwise. There are ways to look at a hard drive, you know, for those that are doing this kind of research, to be able to really figure out where kids are going. So parents who say, you know, my children are only allowed to go to certain places, if they use the internet unsupervised without the parent standing right over them, many times the kids get around what their parents, you know, wish for them to be doing, mm-hmm. and, you know, ultimately end up in places where they should not be.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there was a software that will send an email to another party that reports every website that's visited, that type of thing.
That's right. There have actually been, you know, software developed. Now, some of this was – the technology was developed to spy on us, you know, and in fact, it's commonly found on most of our computers if we use the internet at all, spyware and logging software that keeps track of where we go, what sites we see, that kind of thing. Well, the constructive use of that is that, you know, we have turned it into a way of holding one another accountable. So it's possible for a person to have every site that they ever visit actually listed and placed in an email and sent to a parent or to an accountability partner or something of that nature for the positive use of just holding us accountable for what we do and what we see. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's also used to gather information about us for research and marketing purposes.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned – I know you've done a lot of court work. You're called in as an expert witness to testify in certain court cases and so on. And you mentioned that there have been cases legally where – I don't know if it's a husband and wife going through a divorce and the wife had the – hard drive subpoenaed or something. Can you elaborate on how that happens?
Well, it certainly happens in cases where a person is found to have child pornography on their computer. You know, that if someone is suspected of or, you know, that they have been involved in communicating and looking at illegal pornography such as child pornography, that those hard drives are confiscated by the police and software is available for them to be able to look at, you know, whatever has been recorded to that hard drive, including much of the information that may have even been wiped out from reformatting a hard drive. So what people don't know is that the logs and some of the records of some of their sites and where they've been still exists, you know, on those, you know, on those reformatted hard drives. We can't see it with our normal software, but, you know, other kinds of software that's used for forensic purposes can reconstruct it. It's also been used in divorce matters where a parent, you know, believes that their spouse is unfit to parent children and may have been involved in some inappropriate internet activity. And so the hard drive can be analyzed by these forensic experts to see if there's, you know, there's a propensity toward some kind of perverse sexual, you know, behavior or whatever that might endanger a child.
You talked about some of the ways to establish accountability even in the home. Mm-hmm. You talked about not having a computer in some private room somewhere, but where the kids are, have it out in more of a public place for the where the rest of the families.
I'm a strong believer in husbands and wives not keeping secrets from each other, and I'm a strong believer in children not keeping secrets from their parents. I mean, I in spite of the messages of our culture that, you know, it's my business and nobody else's business, I mean, I don't think that's true in healthy families, and particularly in Christian families, you know, where we submit ourselves one to another. And so, you know, in my home, my computer, you know, sets in my living room. Mm-hmm. Whatever I do on it can be seen by anyone who chooses to walk through the living room. My wife and I do not have secret passwords from each other. Mm-hmm. We don't access material or email accounts or anything else that the other partner can't also access if they wish. That way we have no secrets, nothing to be ashamed of, nothing that's going to be found out by our partner that they're going to be hurt by or disappointed by. You know, if we have that kind of an arrangement with our relationships, then we're just not as likely to get into trouble as when we delude ourselves into believing that we can keep secret what we're doing. You know, many people quote that passage of Scripture about, you know, what a man sows, you know, that will he also reap. But I think almost the more important words precede it. It says in that verse that, you know, be not deceived. God will not be mocked. You know, whatsoever a man sows, that will he also reap. It's self-deception is what the verse starts off talking about. When we think to ourselves that what we're doing is private, that no one else will know, and therefore there won't be any consequences. I mean, that's the breeding ground for sin. We have a sinful nature. And that nature particularly surfaces when we think that nobody knows what we're doing. And again, that's another reason why people get in trouble on the internet. They may get involved in chat rooms where they're chatting anonymously initially with people. But you build relationships with people that you chat with on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So people who go to the same chat rooms, see the same people, you know, start to communicate with them, you know, in private, you know, sessions or whatever. So you start to build a relationship with someone. And when you do, you know, sometimes you come out of your anonymous role and you start to reveal the truth about yourself. You know, and many, many people have gotten involved in affairs that started on the internet.
Are you seeing more of that in your practice?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, people who are, you know, flirting with other people, even on the internet, you know, many times get caught up in a relationship that they never intended for it to go that far. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, you know, they have built a relationship with someone and then they meet personally or they start to phone one another, you know, and marriages are broken up. People have left their spouses and moved across the country to a person they've never even seen before, but they've only chatted with online or possibly talked to by phone. You know, we had a case in which a husband literally had been corresponding with someone, you know, in Europe, and they literally left their partner and left the country and moved to meet this person. Unfortunately, the relationship, as is many times the case, wasn't at all what it seemed over the internet. And so when these people actually met one another, they were quite disillusioned.
Mm-hmm. What you spoke recently at this conference and you said that when men go to the internet, they're typically, I think, more the visually oriented type of things, and that when women get involved in some of these illicit type of internet activities, it's more of a conversational.
That's right, Tony. I think one of the things that, you know, that clearly men are more attracted to the you know, visually oriented stimuli. And, you know, in fact, I think it was in one of those cases, they had taken a look at, you know, if we compared You know, who prefers visually oriented stimuli? Men preferred visually oriented sexual stimuli at a ratio of 49% men to 22% women. Mm-hmm. Now, there's still a group of unaccounted for that didn't specify preference or, mm-hmm. you know, may have found these two different forms either equal or found themselves not attracted to it at all. But when we looked at the number of people who preferred chat rooms and sexually oriented erotica written material, mm-hmm. we found that the figure actually just reversed itself. You know, and it was 49% of the women and 22 versus 22% of the men who preferred that form of sexual material. Mm-hmm. So, you know, clearly women also have temptations and vulnerability and, you know, get caught up in some of these kinds of things. You know, we have long thought that pornography was far worse than some of the things that women are involved in. And there may be some truth to that. Pornography clearly is dangerous. However, women get in difficulty as well. We've had women who have come to our clinic who have been brought by their husbands or, you know, where they've been threatened by their husbands with divorce because they literally spend hours and hours every single day on the internet. And, you know, to the neglect of their children, their husbands, I mean, and I've known people who have spent 8 and 10 hours a day, you know, close by their computer, communicating with a group of people over the internet that they built relationships with. And those relationships become more important than their human relationships, their face-to-face relationships. Mm-hmm. That when the person is, you know, cut off for some reason, or their computer is unavailable, they literally start to show almost signs of withdrawal. Mm-hmm. You know, they get more anxious, they get more irritable, they have trouble adjusting, you know, and so it's very, very dangerous. And people of, you know, all races, all sexual orientations, you know, preferences, you know, whatever, you know, all across the age, you know, group, you know, fall prey to this.
Mm-hmm. You talked earlier about people who maybe stumble across something, maybe out of curiosity they visit a site, see some things, and yet they're able to, you know, walk away from it and say, God forgive me, and they typically don't go back, at least not again and again and again. It's not a habitual thing. It's not an obsessive thing. And yet there are people who do get hooked. It becomes a very strong obsession. You mentioned people just a moment ago spending 8-10 hours. What is the difference between a person who has some casual exposure that they're able to walk away from versus a person who really gets hooked? What are the dynamics involved in that?
Well, again, I think a very large part of our population has at least some curiosity. And in fact, you know, one study that was done by Lori Hall in, you know, preceding a Promise Keepers rally, they surveyed the men that were in attendance, and 50% of the men who attended this Promise Keeper rally had looked at pornography in the week preceding coming to the rally.
Say that again.
50% of the men who came to this rally had looked at pornography in the week before they attended this rally. Mm-hmm. So it's a widespread problem. Now, of those people who are looking at it, we can kind of break it down into various categories. It's not to say that only the sex addict is the one who's in trouble. I mean, a lot of other people get in trouble, but they don't necessarily meet the criterion for addiction. Addiction is that a person is truly powerless. They are obsessed with it. It is interfering with their life and their relationships and their ability to, you know, to take care of their responsibilities. These are people who have made promises to others and promises to themselves that they would stop, and yet they continue on. They seek more and more. You know, the same level of stimulation or arousal that was once experienced can't be experienced without looking at something new or more perverse or whatever. And again, these are people that spend many times hours and hours every single day. And, you know, so those folks are truly addicted. In some cases, we call that, you know, sexual compulsivity. And, you know, for those people, you know, they will need professional treatment. They may need a variety of treatment methods. There are even hospital units that are set up to help people deal with sexual compulsivity. So they may end up going away to a hospital type program, you know, for a month or more, just like rehab for alcoholism. Now, most people don't fit that category. That's about 6% of our population would, you know, meet the criterion for sexual compulsivity or sexual addiction. There's a large percentage of people, though, that look at pornography on a semi-regular basis. You know, they have it, you know, saved to their favorites. They go back to those sites. You know, and if we look at the record of their hard drive, we see, you know, reoccurring, you know, viewing of pornography on some regular basis. And, you know, I'm guessing that that number may be 20 to 30% of men in our culture, at least, you know, have that kind of habitual problem with looking at pornography. Now, again, some spouses don't really have a problem with it. Those couples may not come to therapy. But for those that are Christians particularly and have some level of conviction, there's guilt that's associated with it. There are many spouses, however, who have a major problem with it, and they feel that they are being, you know, betrayed by the partner's behavior, that, that their secret, the secret nature of that, the preferring to look at someone else over their own partner is sinful, is inappropriate, is a boundary violation, is a form of unfaithfulness.
What happens in those marriages? What does that do to the husband's ability to honor his wife, love his wife, focus on her emotional needs? If there's a, you know, it's much more difficult to have a real legitimate relationship where you're dealing with the real issues of life and the challenges of working out problems together versus the quick fix of just clicking on a button and instant gratification.
I think Paul had a grasp on that, you know, in 1 Corinthians 7 when he talks about because there's much sexual temptation in the world, each man should have his own wife, each wife should have her own husband. The husband's body doesn't belong to him alone, but also to his wife. That we are not these individuals who are not accountable to another person. We have responsibilities to one another. If one partner seeks, you know, sexual gratification over the internet, they're not taking their sexual needs to their partner as we were instructed to do in that 1 Corinthians 7 passage. You know, it says in that passage, do not defraud from each other. Don't withhold meeting these sexual needs of one another. So when people are looking to the internet, you know, it's a form of defrauding. They're not taking their needs to their partner, nor may they be meeting the needs of their partner. I think it's harmful and damaging to a marriage relationship to take passion out of the marriage and put it someplace else. Those relationships begin to suffer. That the level of excitement for each other decreases over time. You know, that people find they're more aroused by what they see or read than they are by what they do with their partner or what they see in their partner. You know, sometimes this is combined with lots of other marital problems. So because they're not communicating well, they may not be resolving conflict with each other. They may be angry or resentful toward their partner. You know, this becomes a way of getting needs met rather than going to a spouse. But it's just one more way the marriage is damaged and, you know, the couple's relationship is sometimes slipping away from them gradually over time.
One of the common questions that pastors are asked is, young man, you know, growing up, reading in the scripture such things as, you know, if you lust after a woman, you've committed adultery with her in your heart. And young men and older men, too, who are wanting to be pure before God. And they find themselves with these urges, attractions. And, I mean, in society, sex is everywhere. Every billboard, every magazine, every television show or commercial, it seems, you know, that it's just pervasive in our society. So when an individual is trying to keep their heart pure, not get into lust, how do you help a person differentiate between normal desire and when does it cross a boundary over into sinful lust and things like that? Even the Pope, I think, not to pick on the Pope, but years ago he made a statement that And I don't remember the statement. I sure don't want to misquote the Pope. But something about even having too strong of an attraction to your own spouse or something was lustful and sinful. let you go after the Pope here for a little bit.
Or Jimmy Carter, our president years ago, confessed publicly that he lusted after women or whatever, and certainly that got a lot of publicity.
Right.
I think the problem is that just what Paul says, because there's much temptation in the world. We are tempted. There is a lot out there. You know, in Paul's day, prostitution was rampant, you know, and so there was sex, you know, that was available for sale, just as there is today. It just takes different forms. You know, the fact of the matter is that God has created man and woman to be attracted to one another. So, you know, the drive to have an intimate relationship with someone is part of what, you know, motivates us to seek a marriage relationship. It's what has kept our race alive. Mm-hmm. You know, if it weren't for this desire on our part and the desire to be intimate or to have a family or to be sexually intimate with someone, you know, we may have died out as a species. So God created us for sex, you know, unless we've been given a spiritual gift where we truly have no interest. And Paul had, you know, discussed that kind of gift, you know, that if you don't seek to be, if you don't have a desire for marriage, don't get married.
Right.
If you don't have a passion, you know, a fire that's burning within, then be content to be single. But most people do have that desire for some intimacy. And once we get married, you know what many people are surprised to find, because it's kind of a myth that once you get married, the problem stops. The problem of lust, for instance. Not true. The simple fact of the matter is that throughout our life, we have seen persons of the opposite sex, found them attractive. And now, in some cases, it's just the visual image without ever having any conversation with that person. In other cases, that arousal comes, or that attraction comes, the passion comes as a result of meeting someone, getting to know them at a deeper level. Even when the relationship starts off to be totally innocent, where there's no intention whatsoever for it to turn sexual, you know, people end up finding themselves attracted to someone, you know, desiring to be with them, you know, spend time with them. Maybe even it's not sexual fantasy or a desire to have sex with that person initially, but then that passion for that person grows to be more and more intimate, more and more personal. And that's why, you know, people who are married sometimes end up in affairs where they just haven't been careful about their boundaries. I think we have to define what lust is, and I think a lot of people feel guilty that they see someone, they notice something, maybe it is a sexual feature, and they visually notice, and sometimes it's hard not to notice. Mm-hmm. I mean, people, the way they dress, you know, with immodesty, advertise some of those sexual features. And so, you know, we see them, we can't help but notice them, and there's kind of that initial thought, that's sexual, you know, wouldn't it be nice to see more, or some mm-hmm. thought like that. I don't think that's lust, frankly. Mm-hmm. The initial thought that comes to our mind. Now, over time, however, people who have kind of programmed themselves to allow themselves to undress another person in their mind or whatever, what they've done is they program themselves to have that response. Mm-hmm. You know, what I think is that we're responsible to discipline our thought life. It's not the initial thought that comes through our mind that's the problem. It's the second thought, the third thought, what comes after. I think God has designed our mind to consider all alternatives. As a problem-solving person, we are faced with any kind of a problem, whether it's a financial problem or whatever. How many people have humorously thought to themselves, if I could just rob that bank, my financial problems would be over, you know, or if I could just get one of those insider stock tips, you know, I could solve my problem, or if I could just go to Vegas and somehow have, you know, a way of cheating the system that, you know, that I could be out of my difficulty. Now, having the thought doesn't mean we're serious about committing the crime. And so, you know, the thought comes to our mind, you know, we obviously rule it out. It's unreasonable. It's not an option. You know, we're not going to commit a crime, you know, just because, you know, we struggle financially. And in the sexual realm, the same thing happens. The thought comes to our mind, you know, wouldn't that be nice? But clearly we realize that's not an option, that's not appropriate. And so the proper response is to discipline our thought life. Unfortunately, if we don't and we continue to dwell on those things that we see with our eyes, you know, that would not be permissible to act on, you know, because it would be sin, that's lust. Mm-hmm. And it's the mulling over of the thought of committing that act that would ultimately be sinful that's wrong. I mean, clearly here's a place where the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church differ. You know, the Catholic Church has a procreative bias. I mean, basically the Catholic Church's position is sex is for the purpose of procreation. As a Christian, as a Protestant, I don't necessarily hold that view. I think God has given sex to married persons to meet multiple needs, to meet emotional needs, to draw two people close to each other for pleasure, for adventure, you know, and to you know, create babies. So I think there are lots of different reasons, good reasons, why Christians have sex with each other in the context of a holy relationship, a marriage relationship.
I remember reading some of the statements from some of the early church fathers, and some of the statements to the effect that the Holy Spirit leaves the room when a married couple has sex, that married couples were urged to abstain from sexual intercourse for a certain, I don't know how many hours prior to receiving communion. One of the early church fathers referred to sexual intercourse among a married couple as a bestial act. There was just such a negative bias against that. Any and all kinds of sexual or pleasurable feelings were condemned.
And it's wrong, interestingly. You know, the Puritans were the ones that kind of got the bad rap for being hung up about sex. But to read some of the early Puritan writers, they were very liberated in their sexual notions. Hmm. Anything and everything goes between a husband and a wife. But there's the caveat. It's between a husband and a wife, and it's anything that is acceptable to the two of those two persons. Mm-hmm. That was the writing of the early Puritans. It was the Victorians, frankly, that kind of had some of these notions that, you know, sex was somehow dirty, evil. We separated that from, you know, it was kind of the base part of our life or whatever. You know, I don't think that God had hang-ups about sex. You know, looking at the Song of Solomon, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, there have been some great literal studies looking at the passion of Solomon and Shulamite and the love, the desire, you know, I mean, some would call it lust. He had a desire to be intimate, you know, with her when he was away from her. And, you know, that has obviously been used as an allegory for the passion that God has for his people. But it's the closest thing on earth that we have to that kind of, you know, godly love that God has for his people. I think it's something beautiful. It's nothing for a husband and a wife. Once again, when we think about doing something that wouldn't otherwise be sinful, it can't meet the definition of lust. Mm-hmm. Lust is to seek after those things, to desire and play out in your mind a scenario that if you actually did it, it would be sinful.
Mm-hmm. What in years of working with folks, one of the – and I'll share this with you and you can say, yes, that's good or no, it's not. Feel free to – have at it. But what I've shared with individuals is that there's a difference between the presentation of temptation versus participation in temptation.
Sure.
And there's absolutely nothing that an individual can do, by and large, to prevent the presentation of temptation. Jesus said, "Watch and pray, lest ye enter into temptation." But he didn't say, "Watch and pray, lest ye be tempted."
Right.
And that when the presentation of temptation comes, now there could be some things I could do. I could go to parts of town or go to parts of the internet that would certainly set me up for additional presentation. But
absolutely,
that's not what I'm really referring to.
When we type the sexual words into our search engine, we've crossed the line.
True.
if you naively click on an email, not having an idea of what's in it, you know, and it happens to be sexual, you're not responsible for that. Mm-hmm. But when you've received similar kinds of email in the past and you know what it is and you open it, then you've clearly made a deliberate
You've begun to participate in temptation at that
That's
point.
That's right.
But I've shared with individuals who were – they were feeling guilty for having these feelings of attraction. And on one hand, you don't want them to entertain it, mull over it, further mentally progress into the thing. But on the other hand, you don't want to see people feeling unnecessarily guilty simply because a thought came to their mind.
That's right.
And then feeling like, you know, they're condemned and they've committed the unpardonable sin. Sometimes I find people need to resist something instead of repenting for it because they really haven't done anything to repent for.
That's right. I mean, in psychology, we call that neurotic guilt. You know, in Christian circles, sometimes it's referred to as false guilt, but where a person really feels guilty, but they really haven't done anything wrong. It's just that they're aware of their nature. They're aware of their sin nature. They're aware of their attraction to, you know, some things that are not not right to pursue. And that's conviction. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we become aware that it's not right to pursue it, you know, that's where the Holy Spirit is trying to speak to us, that it's wrong to go there. If we ignore those signs, then, there is danger ahead. I think James talks about lust, you know, produces sin, which produces death. There's a progression, you know, and so, you know, many times people have those, the evil desire that then produces their lustful thoughts where they begin to play out the sinful acts in their minds. And then people tend to do what they think. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. Cognitive psychology says what we think determines not only how we feel, but what we do in our actions. So if you think about something long enough, you become desensitized to it, and ultimately then the act, it doesn't have the same level of conviction that goes with it. The conviction preceded, but people have kind of have become desensitized even to the signs of conviction. I think this an example that's probably the most damaging to marriage is the building of emotional relationships with members of the opposite sex that become emotional affairs that are never sexual at all. There are people, and in fact, you know, those kinds of emotional affairs are sometimes more dangerous and damaging to a marriage even than a sexual slip where someone has a, you know, one night stand in a vulnerable time or place or whatever. Not that that's okay and not damaging, but in terms of the damage to the marriage, the having an ongoing relationship with a member of the opposite sex that becomes more and more intimate in conversation, that becomes more and more revealing, where a person pursues that relationship more than they pursue their own spouse, that is very wounding and damaging to marriage. And sometimes some of those relationships never recover. People say to themselves, well, but we're not having sex, we're not having an affair because we're not having sex. It's not true. I mean, clearly their spouse wouldn't think that's true. And if that were true, why would they keep secret the nature of their relationship? In my belief, an affair begins when a partner keeps secrets about the nature of their relationships, you know, with other people. So whenever I have to hide from my partner what I'm saying, what I'm doing, how I'm saying it, you know, at that point I've crossed the line. And when I share intimate secrets with someone, you know, that's absolutely damaging and harmful to my partner. My partner would be threatened appropriately, you know, by that kind of behavior.
Let's go back to the original scenario you introduced. A couple contacts you. He's been found to be, you know, active on the internet, pornography. His wife caught him a few years before and confrontation just between the two of them. Now it's resurfaced maybe two or three times. This couple comes into your office. What do you do to establish guidelines for this individual?
Well, sometimes the spouse has also read, you know, books and heard mention of sexual addiction. And so many times the spouse has already diagnosed their partner as a sexual addict. I mean, they're certainly right to believe that they have a problem in their relationship. They probably do not meet that definition we talked about earlier where they're truly powerless, where they're progressing to more and more and more and you know, more serious kinds of behaviors, you know, even behaviors that become illegal. Most sexual addicts kind of cross those lines. The person may very well have problems with impulse control. They may very well have a problem with – it's like problem drinking that's not necessarily at the alcoholic level. So one thing is, I think, to help reassure the partner that maybe it's not as hopeless as what they might have read when they've read material about sexual addiction. I mean, it's a very, very bleak picture if you read much about true sex addiction. Those persons often struggle with this their entire life and, you know, and end up, you know, in trouble with the law and other kinds of things.
Dale, could you insert here, what are some of the things that a true sexual addict, what are some of the behaviors they'd be involved in?
Certainly the viewing of some kind of sexually explicit material, and many sex addicts were exposed to that kind of material at a very young age. Most sex addicts were themselves either physically molested or sexually molested as children. Now, that's not to say that everyone is, but many were. That many people start off with pornography and maybe masturbation to the stimulation of pornography, but then they start to, you know, peep in windows, or they start to expose themselves, or they start to seek illicit sexual activity. You know, they become promiscuous, or they pay prostitutes for sex. You know, that may not be enough, and it, you know, goes to touching people, or, you know, making sexual advances inappropriately to people, you know, that are quite offensive to those unwilling persons. Some people make, you know, telephone calls, you know, of a sexual nature to people, you know, which is against the law. Some people, you know, truly molest others. They touch people in sexual ways without the consent of that person, and they find themselves, you know, arrested. You know, and once again, many of these behaviors that I'm talking about are illegal. Mm-hmm. And in the worst cases, it may involve rape and, you know, molesting children, things that where the person is so out of control with their behavior, they can't stop themselves from doing things that not only give them gratification, but also hurt other people and damage other people.
So we're not saying that simply viewing pornography on the internet is okay.
No.
But the true sexual addiction very often escalates way, way beyond that into other behaviors.
That's right. Okay. So the behavior is very damaging, very dangerous, and in many cases illegal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at that point, people really aren't in control of themselves well. Now, again, looking at pornography and not resisting the impulse that goes no further than that, that's only occasional. Really, it's kind of not proper probably to call that sexual addiction, but many people do. Mm-hmm. So, well, maybe we just don't have to be that technical about
right.
our language.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's still a serious problem, mm-hmm. and we need to treat that serious problem. And so we have to help that person who, you know, kind of has this habit of going back to and not resisting the temptation. And in some cases, people do away with their computers. If they don't have a need to have a computer in their home, mm-hmm. you know, the danger of having that computer in the home may far outweigh any advantages or benefits mm-hmm. that the computer provides. Now, people who use the computer for business, and by the way, 70% of people, men in the workplace, have looked at pornography on their work computer.
Mm-hmm.
70% of men. You know, in studies where companies go in and start examining the content of hard drives or whatever, that behavior is maybe not illegal, but it violates company use policy. And many people come to us after they've been fired from their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They may have had very successful jobs and been otherwise good employees, you know, who have been simply fired because of what they did. And certainly if they communicate some of that information to other persons, and particularly unwilling persons in their office by email or whatever. For instance, people sending sexually oriented jokes to other, you know, people on their email list. Someone who takes offense at that constitutes sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And so once again, consequences can be, you know, being fired or even sued by, you know, employees or those kinds of things. So we definitely need to help the person stop themselves. You know, the commitment to stop is a big thing, but also the realization that they're going to need help. That sometimes people keep thinking to themselves, well, even though I've tried it before, I promised before that I'll stop, I'll just promise again. Not. It doesn't work. It's not enough.
Does that often come during the remorse after the fact?
Yes.
And
yes.
That lasts for a short time.
Sometimes hours, mm-hmm. you know, or maybe days or weeks, you know, and maybe depending on the severity of the consequence, maybe that does last for weeks or months. But to think that a person is out of the woods, you know, simply because they got caught finally. There were some consequences that for the time being they're sorry. It's on their mind how dangerous it is or how bad the consequences can be. That's a temporary deterrent for people who've had a chronic problem with this. Mm-hmm. So people who've had a chronic problem will need some kind of in-depth counseling, and particularly the kind of counseling that addresses the content of their thought life, the content of their erotic, you know, thought life in particular. I mean, you know, anyone who is sexual, you know, who has an active sexual relationship with someone has sexual thoughts. We don't have sexual feeling if we don't have some kind of sexual thought. Well, what we need to take a look at is what is the content of that sexual thought? If that person is constantly in a roving, seeking, you know, looking for, you know, seduction opportunities or, you know, looking for new stimulation, new visual images, if that's the content of a person's thought life, they're really going to need some help to break the habits of those things. And frankly, people can promise to solve those problems and claim to have solved those problems, but many people, because of the shame or whatever, are really not truly honest about their continuing struggle. Mm-hmm. And particularly if there's some kind of, you know, consequence that's facing someone, you know, people sometimes are simply not honest about the depth of the problem in their thought life. Well, a person who really wants help will be honest about the struggle, will, you know, be willing to spend some time with someone who can help them look at the content of their thought life, to change the content of their thought life, to discipline their thought life, and ultimately to change also the behaviors that go with their thought life. Mm-hmm. That if we can solve the problem at the thought life level, that truly we can solve the problem of lust, the habit of lust, then it's unlikely that people will continue the behavior, but behavior may also need to change. Changing internet providers, adding, you know, different kinds of software to, you know, to filter out, you know, pornography, using the accountability software to keep track of the kinds of sites we go to, keystroke software that literally keeps a record of every single thing you do, you know, on the computer. You know, every key that you strike, you know, becomes a file that can be viewed by someone that's your accountability partner. So there are things that can help, but those things alone will not solve the problem of a person who still has a roving mind, mm-hmm. you know, who is in a habit of seeking new sexual images. And, you know, that unless we address that thought life problem, we will not stop the behavior. People will get around every kind of safeguard we can put up, mm-hmm. I mean, including borrowing someone else's computer.
Mm-hmm. You talked about an accountability partner. When there's been an offense take place, a severe offense, is the wife always the best person to be that accountability partner, or is it good sometimes to bring in a male friend who can provide some man-to-man accountability? You know, sometimes a wife ends up feeling kind of like a parole officer in her own home.
I think that, frankly, I think all men need to have an accountability partner. I don't think you have to have a problem to have the need for mm-hmm. intimate relationships with man to man. You know, intimate in the sense that we're honest with each other. We mm-hmm. tell each other the truth. Mm-hmm. We don't keep secrets about some of our, you know, basic struggles, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And notoriously in our culture, men are not good at that kind of friendship relationship. Mm-hmm. I think we all need it, and I think it helps us grow. It is not good for a marriage relationship for a partner to become the policeman to their spouse, where the partner is constantly suspicious of the activity of their partner, where trust is not rebuilt, where, you know, but yet there still is always a level of accountability that is necessary in a marriage relationship. The more trouble the person's thought life and behavior have become, the more necessary it is to have multiple accountability relationships. So I am accountable to my spouse, and just like the deal that my wife and I have with each other, she has full access to my computer. Mm-hmm. She has my passwords. You know, I'm not afraid of her getting into my computer, mm-hmm. and, you know, vice versa. I mean, we don't have a need to go checking on each other on a, you know, regular basis, because there's nothing there. If you've checked a few times, you kind of get bored with it. But you can always check, you know, and frankly, I think it's healthy to know, that we are all vulnerable. I think the person who says to themselves, my spouse would never, ever do anything like that, is naive. Mm-hmm. Many people come to us very self-righteous after their partner has had an affair. Frankly, I think the vast majority of people could have an affair under the right circumstances. Now, hopefully, most people are careful enough not to put themselves in those circumstances, mm-hmm. And certainly not willingly. But, you know, I think most people are vulnerable, you know, that if we weren't getting the attention of our partner, if we were lonely, if we were out of town, if we were separated for a long period of time, I mean, under the right circumstances, many, many people could find themselves vulnerable. Some, you know, caring person who's a friend, you know, just shows an interest in us, cares about us, you know, is thoughtful toward us. You know, we find ourselves attracted to that. You know, we may be willing to spend more time with them. And there's the beginning of a dangerous relationship. You know, and many people just don't see it at the time, don't recognize the danger. So I think we need accountability, having men to men, women to women accountability groups and partnerships and in-depth studies where we truly pray for one another, where we confess our sins to one another and pray for one another that we might be healed. I think that's extremely necessary. But then to communicate openly and honestly, husband to wife to husband, mm-hmm. is necessary for a healthy marriage.
Mm-hmm. When Jesus talked about issues of lust and adultery, he said, if you're I offend you, pluck it out. If your hand offends you, cut it off. We hope and trust and assume that he didn't mean for that to be taken in the most extreme literal possible way. What does that mean to you? What are the practical applications of that?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly if you thought it could ultimately be literal, then you would be highly motivated to solve the problem short of losing an eye or a hand or whatever, your mouse-clicking finger, I guess. You know, I think that, you know, we need to take it seriously, that this is that these are serious problems. To continue sinful behavior is dangerous to our spiritual life. You know, we all need to have a healthy fear, you know, of the wrath of God, you know, even for the Christian, you know, that there are consequences. Even though we've been saved, even though we may be, you know, going to heaven, there still are consequences, and the consequences can be quite severe, including, you know, for sex addicts who have crossed some of these lines, going to prison. That's a pretty that's a pretty strong consequence, mm-hmm. you know, to motivate us not to continue doing those behaviors. So I think consequences should motivate us to, you know, stop our behavior. We should be warned. Again, be not deceived. Don't tell yourself that you can get away with doing what you're doing in secret, you know, thinking that it'll never surface. You know, I don't think there's any such guarantee. And in fact, mm-hmm. you know, as the Holy Spirit shines its light, sometimes the light gets brighter and brighter. Mm-hmm. We just hope it stops before it's the light at the police station.
There you go.
During the interrogation.
The bright lights that are causing you to sweat. Well, Dr. Doty, I want to thank you so much for this time. And one quick question in closing. Let's say we've got an individual listening to this. You know, he's been struggling with issues of, you know, just some lust, trying to keep things in proper perspective, trying to get right boundaries for his life. Are there any particular books, resources, things that you would recommend that could be helpful?
I think there are a lot of good books out there, you know, some from a secular vantage point, some from a Christian vantage point. You know, there are great websites. You know, that same internet that's used for harm can also be used for good. You know, the Focus on the Family website from James Dobson has an enormous library of articles that people can look at and read, you know, on these and other problems, the problem of pornography, the problem of infidelity or sexual addiction, those kinds of things.
And that website is?
I'm not even sure I know.
I do. It's www.family.org.
Family.org?
Yes.
That's right. And so that's one good place to go. It's a safe, reliable source. There are other reliable sources out there, but the difficulty is if you put in a sex term, you're probably going to come up with illicit sites in addition to, you know, the reliable sites. So, you know, it might be good to consult someone. Bible studies that are being done in people's churches today, Every Man's Battle. There's a new book, you know, by the same author, Stephen Arterburn, Every Woman's Battle. And, you know, then we've got Every Young Man's Battle. So they've written a whole series of books to help men recognize their vulnerability, you know, recognize the need to have proper sexual boundaries, to be men of integrity. Many of the Promise Keeper type books talk about the importance of accountability relationships and telling one another the truth. You know, the fellow that really coined the term sexual addiction is Patrick Carnes. He's written a number of books. Out of the Shadows was his first one, and there's a whole series of those. Pretty frightening books when you really read about sexual addiction and how damaging and dangerous it is. An Affair of the Mind by Lori Hall is a book for women, you know, who struggle with partners who have had difficulties with this. False Intimacy by Harry Schomburg is another Christian book it's called False Intimacy, Understanding the Struggle of Sexual Addiction. It's a great book from a Christian perspective. Mm-hmm. And then any book on marriage intimacy, the importance of building an open, honest relationship, being effective in communicating, being effective at problem solving, being effective at maintaining an intimate, passionate relationship with your partner. I mean, one of the best sources of possible insurance that we could have is to take advantage of the relationship God has given us and, you know, and milk it for all it's worth, mm-hmm. to grow as far as we can possibly grow, to keep a level of excitement toward each other, you know, in our marriages. I mean, that's the best insurance I know.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, if you don't mind, Dr. Doty, I'd like you to pray for our listeners. There are pastors listening whose primary interest in listening was to get some skills on how to help individuals in their churches. There are individuals who are going to be listening to this who are looking for how to grow in the fruit of self-control. I know a lot of times people would like just a magic wand type of instant solution, but for the most part, these kinds of things are a growing process in self-control. And I'd sure appreciate it if you'd pray for our listeners that they'd have God's wisdom and God's help as they undertake that journey.
Thanks, Tony. I'd love to. Father, I really do thank you for the opportunity that we have to consider these serious matters. And I thank you for Paul's wisdom when he said to us, there is much temptation in the world, that we are all vulnerable to temptation. And Father, I pray that we would never become desensitized to that, that our temptation is a serious matter, that our temptation, you know, can become the breeding ground for the sin that destroys us as a person, destroys our relationship with you and the people we care about. So I pray, Father, that you will help us all to resist temptation, to flee from it, to run for our lives. I pray, Father, that we will never become desensitized to our struggle with lust, that no matter what form it might come, whether it's in the form of fantasies of romance or fantasies of an explicit sexual nature, whether it's our temptations to, you know, go places on the internet where we would be ashamed if people really knew the whole truth. Father, that when we start to keep secrets from one another, it's a warning sign to us that we're doing something wrong. And we've certainly not kept the secret from you, and we may not be able to keep it from others. Help us, Father, to avoid the behaviors that would make us feel ashamed of ourselves if we were discovered. Help us, Father, to keep our thought life pure, to think about our spouse if we're married, to, if we're single, seek the day when God ultimately provides that holy relationship in which we can find fulfillment for our desires. But, Father, if we've gone too far, help us to truly have a repentant spirit, to be sorrowful for our sin, not to be destroyed by the guilt of it, but to be sorrowful, but also to take serious steps to resist it. I pray that you open opportunities to speak to our pastors or counselors to get the help we need, to go to professional counselors if we've got a serious problem where we've resisted and made promises to ourselves, but we can't keep our own promises. Help us, Father, to go to whatever lengths are necessary to put an end to this before it gets worse, before it destroys us. Help us, Father, to see the danger. But most of all, lead us not into temptation. Lead us instead, Father, to healthy relationships where our needs can be met in a legitimate way, where we have no shame. Help us, Father, to follow your plan for getting our needs met. And I ask for that in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Dr. Doty.
Thanks, brother.